Hello and welcome to Happy Place with me, Fern Cotton. This is the show where we learn about the inner lives of people we might think we know well. Today I'm talking to Tuppence Middleton.
I have OCD and that's one of the things that gets much worse when I'm not working. So what I would call my routines, which can vary from mental counting to checking behaviours, you know, checking lights, checking cookers, they tend to get much worse when I'm in the house a lot and by myself a lot and not working. So those things you find various types of coping mechanisms for, which I think are sometimes helpful and sometimes not.
You might recognise Tuppence from TV shows including War and Peace, which, oh my goodness, I loved so much, and Downton Abbey. And now she's starring in Our House, a four-part, properly edge-of-your-seat thriller on ITV. I mean, I was literally gripping the sofa and at times hiding behind a cushion, but in the best possible way. It's unbelievably watchable. It's based on the best-selling novel by Louise Candlish and begins with Tuppence's character, Fiona, coming home to find strangers moving into her house. I mean, worst nightmare. All her family's possessions and furniture are gone. Then she realises her young kids and a strange husband are also missing. And serious panic sets in from there for Fiona and for you, the viewer. Now, when I was talking to Tuppence, who is so lovely, we ended up talking a lot about panic in this chat, actually. Me about the panic I feel particularly at nighttime, and Tuppence about her OCD and compulsive behaviours. They're things we haven't, I guess, necessarily talked about in great deal on Happy Place before. So I'm incredibly grateful to Tuppence for talking about this and glad that we could really get stuck into a new subject matter that most definitely needs covering.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
All right, are you ready for it? Here's the show. Let's do it. Tuppence.
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm good. Where are you today? Are you at home?
I'm actually in Sweden today.
Oh, what are you doing in Sweden?
My partner lives in Stockholm, so I kind of travel between both. So I'm currently in icy Sweden.
How gorgeous. Do you know what? I've never been to Sweden. It's one of those places where I'm annoyed at myself that I haven't, but it's on the list. I've got to go.
Yeah, it's a really great place. I mean, you can do, if you were just coming for the weekend in Stockholm, you could kind of walk it and see a lot of the city in a long weekend. So it's perfect little short city trip. But it's, yeah, the rest of Sweden, I still kind of want to explore a bit more. And it's really beautiful.
Oh, how amazing. How gorgeous. Now, we've actually never met in person, but I kind of know you through a friend, Justine, who's one of my best mates in the world, who does your makeup occasionally, and I've heard so many wonderful things about you. So I'm really, really glad that we're getting to have a chat today. It's a long time coming, for
There's
sure.
There's been a lot of near misses, I think.
I know. And obviously, in the modern world, it's very easy to do so, but I completely stalk you on Instagram, like we all sort of stalk each other. And your beautifully curated Instagram, which is so gorgeous, because unlike many people out there who are sort of posting pictures of avocado on toast or pretty dresses, you're really specific in how you lay out your Instagram, and it's really more about your photography.
I mean, I don't know if I'd even go as far as to say photography. I feel like that's giving it a bit too much credit, but I don't know. I was always really conflicted with Instagram, as I think a lot of people are if they have a job which is kind of semi in the public eye, in the you know, you're allowing people access to your life, and you can choose how much you do that or not. And that's part of your job. It's an inevitable part of both of our jobs. So you kind of come to accept it. But it's also, you do have a choice about how much you share with people. And for me, the other social media accounts I find interesting to look at usually aren't the ones where I know, you know, an excessive amount about someone's life, or when they're sharing their dinner or constant photographs of themselves, which is totally fine if that's what you want to do. But it's, I don't know why anyone would be interested in that side of my life. So, I try
to use
it.
Well, they definitely would. They 100% would. But it's just, it is getting your own sort of balance right with it, isn't it? And I think mine keeps changing. Sometimes I feel like there's worth in me saying something quite revealing. But then weirdly, the world's gone absolutely crazy. The last few weeks, I've just felt a bit like I want to hide. And I'm only really posting things that hopefully will be of some help or use. And it feels sort of too exposing to post anything else at the moment, because I think we forget that it's been really normalised that we sort of share every part of our lives. But it affects you in a way. And it's strange having people you don't know stuff about you. It's such a weird concept that we've normalised.
Yeah, and it's also, it's so dependent on how you're feeling that day or that week or that month. You know, sometimes you feel really happy with how your life's going and you want to share that with people and talk about what you're doing, the projects you're doing, about your life. And then sometimes you do want to hide and you don't really want people to have access to that. So yeah, it's a tricky thing, because then I think that you can give a certain amount and then maybe people expect something from you, and that's quite difficult to maintain that level of openness with people that you don't know. So I think it's a constant sort of battle. And you know, and then you come up against, you know, what we're all experiencing now. And I've spent most of my morning scrolling, kind of doom scrolling the internet, terrifying myself about potential nuclear war and what's going on in the world. Yeah. And then you really think, God, if I post this picture, a picture or a statement on Twitter about something really normal or something to do with your life, does anyone even care? Is it, what's the point? You know, you kind of, everything's always, you're weighing things up against each other all the time.
It's a weird way of expressing ourselves, and most of us do it. And I think it's just a constant, you know, sort of checking in with yourself and your own barometer of what feels right. But yeah, it's very strange. But anyway, going back to the initial point, I think yours is very beautiful, and I really like that it's quite different to many other people's out there. And I really enjoy sort of seeing, I think you get a sense of who you are from it, from the sort of the black and white photos and the subjects that you choose to picture. It's really beautiful. And obviously we're catching you today at a really busy time, because our house is out next week. This will be going out, I think, the week that it goes out. And because it's March. Oh, my God. Terrifying. It's already nearly March. And also the Downton Abbey movie is coming out as well. So and I'm sure you're working on a ton of other stuff too. How do you deal with very busy periods like that, where you have lots of things launching at the same time? Do you experience overwhelm, or are you quite laid back about it all?
I don't know that I'm laid back about anything. But I think that it's quite a different experience, I think, being busy making something and being busy promoting something. That they're sort of two quite different beasts, I suppose. I think I much prefer to be busy in the making of something, when you're filming and you're in that routine of, early mornings and long days. And I find that very good kind of mental health wise as a something to focus on and distract myself from other things. But the promotion side is... it's a kind of double-edged sword, because you obviously always want people to see something that you've done and that you're proud of, and you want as many people as possible to enjoy it. But then you are also putting out a much more personal side of yourself. If you turn up to an event, if you are interviewed as yourself and you're not playing a character, then I find that much more stressful than the process of actually creating something. So it's really fun and it's really nice. And, you know, when lots of things come at once, that's always the beauty and sometimes coincidence of timing. But I think, it can be a bit overwhelming at times. You just have to take it in your stride. And, you know, like I said, whatever else is going on in the world often affects you know, your reaction to that? You think, okay, don't be so stupid. There are bigger things out there. It's just an interview, or it's just a appearance, or whatever you're doing. It's, you have to put it in perspective.
You do, but it is, you know, I am only ever myself when I'm broadcasting or in the public eye. I can't ever, there's no other side to it. I don't get to sort of play a role, but I still find it terrifying. I still find promoting books or whatever terrifying, because I'm out of control. You know, I'm much more in control when I'm the interviewer rather than the person on the other end of it. So it is exposing, and it is quite scary. And then, of course, there's that other bit that most would think is utterly glamorous, and the sort of coveted bit where you're walking down the red carpet or you're wearing some beautiful gown, you've had your hair and makeup done. I mean, I don't ever particularly love that bit. How do you feel about that?
Oh, God, it's awful. I mean, I know that's the thing that always looks the most glamorous and should feel the most exciting, but I'm always anxious before I go to any red carpet events. I always, you know, it's always a rush. You've never got enough time. You're kind of making decisions on the outfit really last minute, and then you are kind of thrown in front of all these people, especially if it's a kind of big red carpet event, something like, you know, the Downton Abbey premieres are always quite big events, and it's just really overwhelming on the senses. And you know, stupid things that you carry with you for life. Like I've had horrible skin. I mean, you know, kind of teenage acne since I was basically hit puberty. And I think that's something that I'm always so aware of and insecure about, and things that other people don't see or don't care about, and perhaps are in your head even more than you think. But it's, yeah, just little things become huge, and you're so overtly aware of everything.
Well, you've got all eyes on you, which is so unnerving. And then there's sort of that bit where everyone's looking, but there's also then if photographs are taken, and then you might have to see them afterwards. I'm like, nope, don't want to look, Like, it's just, it's quite an unnatural thing. I mean, we're all experiencing it on some level again because of social media and how out there we can all be. But it's funny. I think we've all become probably slightly more judgmental about ourselves and each other because of that. And the red carpet is almost sort of the pinnacle of that. Like, all eyes on you, looking for any flaws or any oddities or whatever it might be, which is crazy, because that's certainly the stuff that I celebrate, if anything, in real life. But there's still this discord when it comes to the mainstream media and how women are seen. It's very odd.
And it's also that instantaneous nature of everything. You know, you can be a few seconds away from the red carpet having just left it and having just had your photo taken, and then it's already on the internet before you've left the event. And you know, it's on social media in a way that you can zoom in so close onto details that it's horrific, really. What the technology has done to, you know, it's so, I look at those kind of old, beautiful, very, you know, admittedly very staged old Hollywood portraits of stars and starlets, and they're all so soft filter and posed, and that it was one or two photographs that are released and there was no paparazzi. And it's such a different world now. You're under such intense scrutiny.
I know. Oh my God, I've just had this awful flashback of like this one time. This is yonks ago. I don't even know how many. It's probably like 15 years ago or something. And I went to, people are going to Google this now, which is such an unfortunate thing that I'm bringing this up. But I went to the Brits, and I was wearing this dress that was made of lots of sort of metal beads. And I thought, oh my God, this is so edgy and cool. But like, I was in a rush, I'd come from radio, whatever I was doing. And I thought, brilliant, I just need nude underwear underneath and I'm good to go. You can't see any of that. Obviously, the cameras flashed, and I had it was just my underwear. So we could see me walking with underwear on, and big Spanx, and a horrible nude padded bra. And just, I mean, it's not the end of the world, but it was mortifying and utterly gross. I mean, the whole thing is hideous. So look, let's talk about, I know, it's very, very traumatic. Let's talk about Our House, which I absolutely loved. I was lucky enough to get a preview link sent over I could watch it. And I was watching it at home. My husband walks in, and then all of a sudden he just didn't leave. He was there. He was fixated. He was glued. He loves things that are very high octane and stressy. I sometimes find them harder to watch, but I found this was very manageable because it wasn't too traumatic or awful that I couldn't watch it. It was just, it kept you on the edge. And I always find it really fascinating that Now, undoubtedly, this will be a huge hit. It's a massive ITV show, and it's got that amazing storyline. But I always find it so interesting that psychologically, we love watching things that are utterly terrifying and stressful. What is that about?
I know. I've also found that in, I think particularly over the last couple of years, I suppose the pandemic years, but really over the last few months, I have found myself really craving horror, and I'm a real scaredy cat. I really frighten easily. I watch everything through my fingers like
Same.
A little girl, but there's something about it which is really addictive. And I just keep wanting to find something that will scare me more, even though I know, I mean, I get scared at the most ridiculous films, but I still want to find the ultimate scary film that makes me not want to sleep at night. But I don't know. I think it's, especially when you're going through really stressful times in your life, I think it's a kind of release. And often, you know, horror films are, of course, reflecting the times that we're living in. And so I think people always do go to horror as a sort of escapism. But yeah, I think especially, you know, with something like Our House, because it's, that thriller element is a little bit more manageable, I think, for a lot of people than out and out horror. And I think because there is also this other storyline, which is really the breakdown of a relationship, then it's more manageable because you can dip in and out of the thriller element. You're kind of flipping between these two timelines, and there is something which is grounding it in reality, as well as all of these kind of extraordinary things happening, you know, and driving the story forwards. It's also just a kind of sad story about a love story sort of in reverse. You're kind of you're seeing the gestation of this relationship and then how it's slowly falling apart. And that's unfortunately something a lot of people have gone through or are going through and understand. And, you know, so many people have blended families and, you know, second, third, fourth marriages, and you know, it's a really common thing. So I'm hoping that there will be something in there that people can relate to.
Without a doubt, you know, we have a blended family, and it is so, obviously so common. Tons of my friends are in the same boat as me, or are going through divorces, breakups. Yet we don't see that relationship breakdown, and also the very mundane, practical aftershock of such a thing, which this show. Yeah. Really interestingly offers up. You don't see the kind of who's going to live where, how do we do that, who has the kids when. Like, that's all part of a very long, painful process for people breaking up that we just don't see. So I thought that was such an important element of it.
Yeah, and I actually hadn't really come across this idea of bird nesting, which is one of the storylines in the show, where the central couple, Fee and Bram, are going through a separation and they're trying to work out what's best for the kids. And they come up with the solution called bird nesting, which is apparently becoming much more common, where the kids stay in the family home and the parents come and go. So they rent a smaller flat and they take it in turns to stay in the family home. And there are elements of it which are great and a good idea and really helpful for the kids. But also, it prevents the relationship having any real closure. And there's, you know, a lot of other material and financial elements which are then kind of linked for the foreseeable future. And it's really, it's messy. And I'm sure that for some people it really works if the relationship is amicable, which, you know, at a certain point it is between our characters. But yeah, it's there's so many ways to go through a separation or a divorce, and none of them are the right way or the wrong way. It's just what works for those people.
Exactly. It's got to work for you and your ex and the kids, and whatever you deem is right is right. You know, there is no wrong or right. And that's why it was really interesting. I'd never actually heard of that setup either. And it was, you know, very interesting thing to learn about. And obviously you've got Fee also going through right at the start this utter nightmare of coming back to her utterly gorgeous house, dark blue, sort of sexy house, and then you've got another family in there. I mean, it's just the worst possible start in the best possible way, because you're gripped, you're thinking, what the bloody hell is going on here? I mean, your character is stressed a lot.
Yeah.
How did you, I mean, and rightly so, because her life is literally falling apart at times.
Yeah.
How did you cope with that? Because obviously you've got these long filming days for long periods of time where you're reenacting someone who is severely stressed out, who's getting divorced, who's lost her home, who's completely confused at what the hell's going on and where her kids are at points. How do you deal with that? And does that affect your own mental health when you're outside of work doing your own thing?
Yeah. Well, when we were filming our house, it was... the country wasn't in full lockdown, but certainly the industry was still behaving as if it was, because that's the only way you could really make anything.
And still insured. Now,
yeah, exactly. Like today, to some extent, and because Martin and I were in every day of the shoot, then there's this huge responsibility on your shoulders. You know, you feel responsible for the crew. You don't want to go and do anything on a weekend because you're too scared to get COVID and infect everyone, and then the whole thing shuts down for 2 weeks if you can't go in and work. So I really did just do this job, and that was what I did for, you know, I don't know how many, 2 or 3 months. But there's something quite focusing about playing a character who's in constant turmoil, because then you just channel it into the everyday at work and you don't really have to take it home with you. So I felt, I'm always much calmer in general when I'm working. I think that when I'm not working is when my mind has too much time to overthink and overanalyze, and that's when I tend to be more kind of mentally stressed anyway, I think. So it was more about keeping on top of the story in terms of, okay, we have these two storylines running concurrently, and both of them are quite high anxiety, and, you know, but also you want to keep the momentum going at the same time as not peaking too soon. You know, you have 4 episodes to tell the story over, and you have lots of things which are happening to this woman which are really stressful, and you have to pitch them at certain points. You know, they can't all be equally stressful or equally catastrophic, because then that's boring to watch. So it was more about, okay, how do I get the narrative to feel kind of balanced and varied, which is, you know, where your director and your co-star, especially Martin, it, you know, comes in very handy. But yeah, I do often find that I'm much, much less stressed when I'm working, even if it's, you know, every minute of your day and you're not sleeping. I kind of like that motor to be running.
Yeah, I hear you. I know that one very, very yeah. well. It's why I often find having a break from work, or like the half term or whatever it is, when the kids are off school and I've taken 4 or 5 days off work, I find it harder, because yeah. it's like, oh, now I've got to deal with all the shit that I've not been thinking about for however many weeks when I've been just on this hamster wheel of work. It's where it all comes to the surface. So in those moments where you get a break in between productions and yeah. you have got to sift through all the mental sort of stuff that's going on there, what do you do? How do you deal with that? If there has been a sort of a dam in place when you've got yeah. you know, a long production and then it's gone, you know, how do you cope with that?
It depends. I mean, usually you kind of find ways to manage it. I think that I always sleep a lot worse when I'm not working. I tend to be a bit more of an insomniac, because nighttime is when my brain kind of comes
same.
Alive, and you know, it's so I still don't know how to deal with it, and I think it's one of those things that just comes and goes. Sometimes I find it really easy to sleep, and sometimes I still think I have that slightly childlike inbuilt resistance to going to bed, that I associate it with I don't know, sort of doom or something, that I'm just going to sit there.
You've got school the next day.
Yeah, exactly. Next day is school, and you know, you don't want to wake up in the morning, because it's that means you have a whole school week, and yeah.
So do you find it harder to fall asleep, or do you go to sleep, wake up, and then you can't get back to sleep?
No, just falling asleep. I think
same.
Once I'm asleep, then I'm fine. I'm kind
same.
Of I'm home free. But I just it's just tossing and turning, lying awake, thinking of all the things I should have done, should have said, need yeah. to do, haven't done, all the things
it.
I should be worrying about, you know. Yeah, that's my main problem. And I think that, yeah, aside from nighttime and sleeping, I'm, you know, I've talked about this previously in another podcast that I did kind of solely about the subject, but that I have OCD, and that's one of the things that gets much worse when I'm not working. So what I would call my routines, or, you know, which can vary from mental counting to checking behaviours, you know, checking lights, checking cookers, checking taps, all of those things, they tend to get much worse when I'm in the house a lot and by myself a lot and not working. So those things you find various types of coping mechanisms for, which I think are sometimes helpful and sometimes not. Like one of the things that that really helps me if I'm struggling to leave the house, which is a thing that sometimes happens if I'm in the house a lot, then I suppose you just start to feel safe there. And then when you leave, there's so many things that come rushing into my mind, you know, mainly things that you're responsible for in your house, you know, that it doesn't flood, that your cat doesn't die, that, you know, you don't set it on fire accidentally and have to pay for all of your neighbors' houses. You know, all of those things which seem totally ridiculous, but that race through your head when you're trying to leave the house in a hurry and then you make yourself late. Then I'd started to, for example, take pictures of things around the house so that if I was on the tube or the bus or walking and I'm half an hour away from my house and I suddenly think, oh my God, I left the tap on, or, oh, I left the hob on, then I can look at my phone and I realise, as long as I trust my eyes in that moment, that which I often don't, but then I can see, okay, that's off and I have physical evidence, which, you know, probably a lot of people would say is slightly enabling my own compulsions, but it's,
no, I think
whatever works.
Yeah, whatever works to settle that fear and that worry, especially if you can't get back to the house. I think you've got to do what you've got to do. And I very much enjoyed listening to that interview that you did with Rose Cartwright, who's obviously an author that's written prolifically about Puro, which she experiences, which is more sort of intrusive thoughts, and she's written brilliantly about that. And it's very generous of you to sort of, you know, go there and offer that up about yourself, because being an actor, you don't have to. It's not, you know, your career isn't reliant on you telling that story. But I just thought it was so generous, because so many people, again, will see you on TV and think, oh my God, she's got it all sus, she's this amazing success and has this wonderful life. And for you to actually go, look, this is going on behind the scenes some of the time, I think is seriously helpful. And when I was listening to that interview, I mean, I learned a lot, certainly. But also, you know, I've never been diagnosed with OCD, but I noticed in times where my insomnia is pretty bad, or even if I have heightened anxiety, panic attacks, which I have quite regularly, I definitely fall into some of these patterns. And it's not all day and every day, but it's certainly, if I'm home alone with the kids and my husband's not at the house, I will check everything before I go to bed. And then often I'll have to get out of bed and do it again. And I don't know, you know, I've never given it a name or looked into it too much. I've just thought, oh God, I'm just a nervous person and this is just how I am. But it was really comforting to sort of hear you both speak so openly and honestly and use the correct terminology, because it just helps you understand it better and helps you sort of realise it. Like the one thing that Rose was saying is, I can go, this isn't me, this is Puro.
Yes.
Rather than going, this is me, I'm flawed, I'm faulty. No, this is Puro, or this is OCD. Yeah. That's really helpful.
Yeah, and also breaking it down into those components. Like you were saying, you will have some of those behaviours which are compulsions, and that they are, you are performing those in as a reaction or as a coping mechanism for something else. So, you know, there's something that you is worrying you or stressing you out. And even if that's not a recurring obsession like someone might have with OCD, then it's still, that's the reaction to it. And there are so many elements, you know, you have your obsession, you have your compulsive behavior or thought that that stems from that. And then even before the obsession, that, you know, that obsession doesn't crop up out of nowhere. That's been sort of brewing for years or, you know, months, however long you've been suffering with it. But that comes from something else. And it's about trying to figure out where that comes from, how you best deal with it. And for me, certainly, there's been so many different manifestations of it throughout my life. You know, when I was a teenager, it was much more counting numbers, mental kind of counting. And then as I got into my late teens and early 20s, it became much more about anxiety and panic attacks and, you know, just a sort of more generalized feeling of anxiety. And then as I've gotten older, it's sort of been more routine based. So all of these things have always been there, but in slightly different forms. And I think they always seem to come from an overriding thought, which is, and it's something I also talked about with Rose, I think, is that I have something called emetophobia, which is a fear of vomiting, which is a really specific fear. And if I ever meet someone else with it, it's always quite exciting because you feel like a total oddball if you have that. And you know, as with a lot of obsessions, you never really talk about them. And if people do see them or they see any evidence of it, they only really see your compulsion. So they see the behavior that comes from that, but they don't really understand why you're doing it and what that comes from. And then when you say something like that, especially, it's so specific and so niche that it's kind of hard for people to understand that can be an overriding thought which affects a lot of your behavior in life. And it's sort of just in the back of your mind, just kind of ticking along. There's not really, you can live a perfectly functioning life with OCD, and for most people it doesn't look like anything's happening at all. And so I think that's why it's quite hard and why I wanted to talk about it in that podcast series and with you, because it's not something that I ever heard anyone talking about when I was, I must have been 11 or 12 when I first started to show signs of it. And my parents hadn't really heard of it. And we had to go to lots of different specialists to talk about it because it just wasn't, it wasn't something people knew much about, or certainly the people didn't talk about publicly. So there was no point of reference, and there wasn't really anyone else I could talk to about it, certainly my age, but even as an adult, that could tell me how to deal with it. So, you know, and there are so many different things you can do, you know, whether you're looking at something more standard talking therapy or CBT, or, and it really is what works for you, I suppose. But I think it's also one of those things, like a lot of other mental health conditions, that you sort of learn to live with. I mean, you can, I'm sure, cure yourself of them. And I'm sure many people have. I don't think that that's been the case with me. But I do think that you also have to find the positives in it. And something that I find really useful about OCD is that it does, at times, force me to really focus my energy. And it can be a kind of driver when you're feeling that kind of anxiety. It can, I always remember someone saying that it's, you are one of the best people in a crisis, because it's almost like you are constantly planning for the worst case scenario. So when it happens, you're able to deal with it quite calmly, actually, which I've often found to be quite true.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
You've said so many important things there, and one of them being that, you know, you're actually quite accepting that you might live with this forever. And I actually had a really similar chat last week with a therapist that I occasionally see, because I'd had really bad anxiety a couple of weeks ago. And we sort of got quite real about it, because I was saying, I have tried so many bloody things for my panic attacks at nighttime. And I sometimes just feel like, you know what, I don't feel in any way in control of this, and I don't think I could ever get rid of this. I just don't see how I could face my past any more than I have. I don't know what else I could do. I feel like I'm failing or something. And she said, well, let's be real here. Like, maybe you won't. Maybe you'll always have panic attacks. And it was actually a relief. Like, oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, like, that's not the end of the world. I don't like them. I would like not to have them, but I have survived for the last 6 years with them, so yeah. I can continue having them. And I think it's sometimes a relief to, rather than us constantly be looking for self-improvement, to fix ourselves, to fix the past, to get over it. I think it's sometimes relieving to go, this might just be it. It's not giving up. It's just having a healthy relationship with what you're dealing with, rather than constantly trying to combat it, I guess.
Yeah, and I think there doesn't have to be a goal, you know, like you said, it doesn't have to be, okay, by this point in 2 years' time, I will have gotten rid of it, because what does that even mean? I think there are so many, there are also so many different levels of it. And I'm, even as I'm talking about it now, I'm so aware that there are people who are housebound because they cannot, you know, leave the house, and they are crippled by a condition like OCD. And I am lucky enough that I'm not in that category, that it's something that I've been able to live with, and that it's, I'm a sort of functioning version of that. And I really sympathize with people who, you know, it can really destroy your life. And then in that case, there are, I suppose, even more intensive therapies and medication that you can look into. But I've found a sort of mix of varying things have helped over the years, depending on how good or bad it is at that time. But yeah, so I think it is about not beating yourself up about that and trying to enjoy those moments where it's not quite as overwhelming as it has been in the past. You know, I really hear you with the anxiety and the insomnia. And sometimes when you're in the middle of a really bad cycle, then you just, it's impossible to imagine ever just going to bed and feeling normal. Yeah. I can't believe that some people just get into bed and immediately fall asleep. That blows my mind.
I know. It's my husband. My husband literally goes straight to sleep, and I can't. I mean, I used to be like that many, many years ago, but, you know, I was a very different person back then. So I can see why, and you can sort of see the thread of it, but it still feels out of reach, or it seems certainly unattainable that there would be another option at times. And that's fine. I think we need to stop being so hard on ourselves. And, you know, you just talked there about the severity of OCD that some people experience. And it's not nice for anyone on any level, but when you are housebound, when it's very severe, it's obviously, you know, horrendous and highly detrimental to your quality of life. Yet you start this Radio 4 interview that you did by telling a story about a mug you'd received at Christmas that summed up so perfectly the feeling around OCD, that there are way more sort of throwaway jokes about OCD.
Yeah.
And it's kind of the butt of a lot of jokes, whereas you wouldn't do that with sort of depression or or acute anxiety. It's so strange.
It's seen as the funny one, I think, as the mental health conditions, because I suppose some of the compulsions can seem so disassociated from the thoughts or obsessions that are causing them, that it's almost absurd, I think, to some other people's eyes. So I sort of understand where that comes from, but it does feel like it's made light of quite a lot, or that it's dismissed as being a sort of ultra form of cleanliness, you know, someone who's a bit of a germphobe. And, you know, especially going through something like a pandemic, that's, I imagine, massively triggering for a lot of people who have OCD. And for me, it was something that, because I already had a lot of fear around the sickness thing, specifically vomiting, not kind of corona or coughing or anything like that, then it felt like the moment where it was announced that people had to start wearing masks in closed off areas, I felt this kind of relief. I thought, God, I wish people had been doing that all the time, because I just felt so often when I've been sat in a room or a cinema and I'm worried that someone's ill and I'm sat next to them and I'm going to catch something infectious, or, you know, every time I go on a plane, I think about it. I scan the crowd of people at the airport, and then everyone, once they're on the plane, to look for signs of possible illness. Are they going to develop some sort of hideous norovirus while we're in the air and I'm going to get it? I mean, it's that kind of constant repetitive thought. And so when COVID came along and we were all kind of forced to be in our houses a lot, not only did that sort of calm me slightly, because I felt that people would be generally more aware of their personal hygiene, washing their hands more. It was something which I'd always done a lot and always had very dry hands. It was also kind of this, kind of an excuse to be more antisocial. And I think that, unfortunately, I'm one of those people who has got that in them. And I think that it's not something that I'm proud of, but I feel like I'm, you know, I always have a lot of guilt with friends who I love and I'm really close to, that I don't know what it is. I just, if a party is cancelled, then I'm thrilled. Yeah. Or if I just
relief.
Just having corona to kind of back me up on the fact that I didn't have to see people as much. Because I just find socializing very tiring. And I love being around people, and I love socializing at work, and I love to spend time more one-on-one with friends, but I do find it, and I have always found it, really hard work. And I, you know, all of my family and close friends know that I hate answering the phone. I hate speaking on the phone.
I don't answer it. No one calls me anymore. No one rings me. I haven't had a phone call in years. I won't pick up. So no one calls.
What is it? I can't get to the bottom. It's so strange.
It's happened. So I had this chat literally yesterday with my husband because it was my son's 9th birthday. We had some people kind of coming and going with their kids, and they're all people I love. That's the disclaimer. I adore them. I love their company. But when everyone had left, I was like, I feel so drained, and I actually feel a bit run down. Like I'm sort of depleted. And actually now I'm beating myself up about it because I feel like there's something wrong with me that I can't just deal with everyday socialising. And the pandemic has 100% made it worse because I didn't have to do it for so long and I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed the bit of it, isolated, that I could just be with my family and not see anyone else. And I, again, worried about that. Am I enjoying this too much? Like, I'm worried that I'm enjoying... And I really now know, as I get older, I need moments of solitude to counterbalance all the talking I do at work or with the mums at the school gate, whatever. I have to go for a walk on my own or just be on my own. But again, I said to my husband last night, I'm really worried about this. Like, I feel like it's going like too far. Like, where does this end? And he was like, you're like Kate Bush. It's a cool thing. It's all good. Like, think like Kate Bush. It's all good. Like, keep going back to Kate Bush. I love Kate Bush. This is fine. But you do question yourself. But I think it's heightened today because we are so used to seeing images on Instagram or wherever it is of people socialising, having fun, living their best life, whatever the hell it is. And we didn't before. And I spent loads of time on my own in my 20s and I didn't know what anyone else was doing. So I didn't really care. I think the problem feels worse than it is because of how we imbibe the lives of others that we don't need to. That must be part of it.
And also because we have access to it. So I can be at home and feeling like I don't really want to see people. But then if I was to put something on social media and they knew I was in London at that time or not working at that time, or I happened to be, and then they send me a message saying, hey, do you want to meet? And then it's
I don't want to meet up.
Yeah, exactly. And I've kind of dropped myself in it. And it's so ridiculous because most of the time it's people I really want to see. But I just... I've had it since I was little, and my sister's very similar actually. And I think you kind of have to laugh about it and you have to be really honest with your close friends about it because I think they know it's not personal, but it's when things started to open up again after the pandemic. I mean, I know it's still ongoing, but as things have started to open up again, it's just, it's very anxiety-inducing that you no longer have a reason to be not there.
And we're so contactable. Like, I really felt this again at the weekend where I had, again, lots of people that I adore texting me or leaving voice notes. I thought, oh my God, I haven't even got time to listen to these voice notes because the kids are shouting at me, whatever the hell's going on.
Yeah.
And it's a bit like people turning up to your house unexpected, like they haven't told you and you've got to be there to welcome them. And if you don't, it's a bit rude. And it's all the sort of new dance of how we deal with this sort of relentless contact that we're in with people. It is utterly relentless. And again, going back even 20 years, and if I think back to my early 20s, I would see very few people, and I would see them like maybe once a week if we'd go to the pub down the road, or maybe they would come to my flat. But it wasn't this sort of expectation that we have to do things and see people all the time. And certainly if you go back 100 years, you would only probably see the people on your street or then maybe a relative who would come visit. But it's so again normalised that we should be seeing new people and big groups of people are going out all the time. And if you're not like that, and you and I clearly are not, and I know there are tons of other people who aren't, you feel like there's no place for you in this weird modern world. Like, where do I fit into this craziness? I don't know.
And even if it's just an ordinary everyday thing, I mean... I'm sure you have the same thing as most people do as adults, that when you go home to your parents' house, you regress and become like 11 years old again.
Of course.
And over Christmas, or, you know, whenever we're all back at home, my siblings and I, my brother's much more social than my sister and I. But I mean, we could be sat in our house my sister and I, my mum will go to the shop and then she will call the house because she's forgotten something or she wants to ask us if we need something and neither of us will answer. And it will go to voicemail and she'll be like, girls, I've just left the house. I know you're there. She might just pick it up. And it's like, or someone will ring on the doorbell and we'll both be in, but we don't want to talk to people because we're just, I don't know. It's just like some strange, I've tried to get to the bottom of it. And my mum was like, I can't believe I raised you this way. What happened? But it's just, I don't know. It's a really funny thing. And I worked with this director who's telling me about, you know, introverts versus extroverts, and that actually so many people think that extroverts are people who are loud and can be life and soul and social.
Not true.
That's absolutely, yeah, I can absolutely do that if needs be. But I think it's about where you recharge, isn't it? If you need time by yourself to feel normal or to go out and then be social again, to feel better, then you're more of a natural introvert. And then if you're the opposite, you need to be around people to recharge. And I've absolutely met people like that and been completely like baffled by them.
Same.
How can that give you energy?
I find it only draining. I don't
know.
Same. I find it only draining. Like, we had this lovely author on called Jedediah Jenkins who described himself, I think, as either a double or a triple extrovert. Like, he needs it. And I was just sat there going, I don't.
Unimaginable.
Doesn't compute. Completely unimaginable. And I think why I was worrying yesterday was I feel I'm getting worse as I get older with it. And I shouldn't maybe use that language, because is it worse? Or am I just honouring who I am? I don't know. It's a fine line between it. It's like,
you do feel really guilty, I think. It's something that makes you feel really guilty. And it's also one of those things which a lot of my close friends are also quite like that. So I can go, I don't know, months, sometimes years without speaking to them. And they will be the same. You know, we almost won't realise that time has passed and it's fine. But then some people who aren't like that, I think, must think I'm the most awful human being on the planet, that I would just let friendships go. Because and it's not because I want to, and it's not because I try to. It's just I have to be. It always works better if there's someone who is either the same or who is a real driver of, like, we have to meet up, let's do this. Because I love it when I'm there. It's just almost like the thought of doing something or being social is too much to actually go through with it.
So, do you know what? I actually really appreciated a moment of absolute clarity yesterday where another of the mums was picking up her son from my house and she went, I'm having a birthday party next week. I haven't invited you because I know you won't come. And I said, thank you, because I won't. And it was just like, there was no hard feelings either way.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah. Oh, you know I won't. And thank you. I appreciate you for actually telling me so I don't find out, even though I probably wouldn't be upset. But it's nice that you've just said it out loud and we're at that place where we can do that. And I thought, that was cool. That doesn't happen very often. Like,
what a
legend.
That
was a moment. What a legend. That was a moment of absolute no bullshit honesty, which I...
Yeah, I see you.
I see you. I love it. Does any of this, whether it is your true nature, same as me, which is to be an introvert, or if we look at your own mental health, or I don't know if you would use the term mental illness with OCD, I'm sure a lot of people would, but does that ever creep into your working life? And if so, how do you deal with it? Because I have certainly had times where my probably more panic attacks have tried to creep in, and I have actually thinking about it, a not dissimilar feeling with your fear of vomiting. Mine is a fear that I'm going to faint. And that's what kickstarts the panic attack.
Yeah.
Like, this is going to be the worst thing ever because I'm going to faint and it's going to be mortifying. And I have felt it. I've been on the edge of it when I've been doing something where I need to be like in the room, focused. I'm talking
live
to a group of people. Or live, exactly. Which has put me off, sadly, doing live a lot because it's too much at the moment for me to cope with that. But if that does come into your working domain, what do you do?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely sympathise with the live thing. I find the idea of doing theatre a lot more terrifying than I do screen work. And I have actually, just by chance, because it happened to be what I started doing when I first left drama school, was doing film and TV. I've done more screen work than I have theatre. So again, you let the fear kind of build up much more because the experience isn't there of, okay, I know I'm going to feel anxious and probably have a lot of adrenaline before I go on, but I can use that in a positive way. I haven't had that experience so much. So anytime I'll do a a personal appearance at an event, if you're presenting an award or something, or going to a red carpet event, then that makes me very anxious, because, you know, you have to be yourself, and there's only kind of one chance to do it. But then also things like, if you are filming something, you know, I've had the experience before where you go into film and you have to do maybe like a kissing scene or something, and perhaps the actor comes in and says, oh God, I've been up all night because my kids have got norovirus, or because I've been throwing up. And you just think, oh my God. And I just spiral into absolute oblivion. And it makes me just want to shut the whole thing down. And oh, can we film this on a different day? And, you know, it's like, it's an uncontrollable anxiety. And, you know, now, I mean, luckily that hasn't happened. I think it's only happened once. But yeah, I try not to let it creep into work too much, I think, because my brain is so busy with everything I have to do that often I don't feel so anxious when I'm actually working. It's more, yeah, like I said, if I'm doing something personal. And there have been times maybe in my kind of late teens, early 20s, where, you know, often for OCD, even though it's not a depressive illness most of the time, then they do sometimes prescribe antidepressants for it. So I, you know, I took a low level kind of anti-anxiety, which helped me at a certain time where I was having a lot of panic attacks. And then, you know, that was just for a couple of years, and then I came off it, and that was what I needed at that time. But I think a lot of people find CBT really helpful, because it's, especially if you have intrusive thoughts, because it's also about kind of countering that with more positive thoughts or more kind of logic-based thinking. But for me, that never worked so much. I think that, I don't even know how I would deal with it now. I've tried meditating. I'm not very good at it, because I think I get too easily distracted. And I have actually downloaded a couple of those apps which, you know, have nice rain sounds and things like that, which I find quite calming. If it's just something that can, you know, sounds of a storm that I put on if I'm trying to sleep and I can't sleep. But
does it help to, like, so I've had this a couple of times where I've just said to the team I'm working with, I might have a fear that I'm going to faint and it might send me into a panic attack, so I just want to say that out loud. And then it sort of makes it go a bit, because it's not the secret that I've got in me.
Actually, that's probably very true. Since I've talked to other people about it, and since I've, you know, talked openly about it, which I didn't always in a kind of work context, then I think at least, you know, people understand it and it's out there, and it's not going to come as a complete curveball if suddenly you have a panic attack or you feel anxious or you explain a kind of crazy thought that you've been having about something which has come out of the blue. Yeah, so I think it does really help just being honest about it, because I think most people can see the lighter side of it, and also can understand, because I think it's hard to meet someone now who hasn't at some point in their life gone through a pretty stressful period which has caused them some mental distress, or, you know, a version of depression or a version of an anxiety attack. I think most people understand what that's like now, because we live so much of our lives online and by ourselves, that I think it's inevitable.
It is, you know, and sadly, statistics show that more people are dealing with anxiety and more people are dealing with panic attacks, and actually in much younger age groups than we've known about previously. Part of that might be because we're more willing to talk these days, but I think also it is due to how fast we're living and how much information we're constantly bombarded with, and how much information we believe we need to take on board, because again, it's been so normalised. So I think you're so right. It's really, that's the wonderful bit of it, is that you realise all of these thoughts or worries, concerns or things that you feel are huge problems, so many other people are going through, and that's a relief in itself. You know, even just to talk to you today about wanting just to not see anyone, like, that's relieving to me, because I really worried yesterday, like, there's something wrong with me. And it's just lovely to know that so many other people feel like this. We just don't hear about it.
Yeah, and I think it's equally as important to not make light of or not undervalue the feeling that you get if you're going through something really stressful, or if you're suffering with anxiety attacks. But then also on the flip side, to think, if I'm this much in my head, then likelihood is everyone else's as well. Yeah. So no one really cares. I mean, they do, of course, and they want to help and they want to understand. And you know, they care about your well-being if it's someone you're close to. But it's also about sometimes like giving yourself a reality dose. Okay, I'm worrying about this thing which feels so huge in my head now. But try and put that in the context of real life and what's going on in the world. And also just, you know, am I going to be thinking about this one thing in a week, in a month, in 5 days? You know, sometimes you can work yourself into such a kind of state about something. And if you just try and project yourself a bit into the future and think this is going to pass, then I think also that, you know, that I think that the one thing I found really probably off-putting when I first entertained the idea of therapy or anything like that was all of the language that kind of came with it. I found it really, it felt like language that didn't apply to me. And I felt like it was, which sounds really awful, but I felt at the time that it was kind of wishy-washy. Like, I didn't really know what mindfulness meant. And I didn't know what, you know, someone saying that they're catastrophizing or that they're self-sabotaging. And all of this kind of, I felt like it wasn't real language that I could grasp onto, and it put me off the idea of therapy. I thought, oh, there's nothing wrong with me. I just have this one thought which recurs a lot, or I do these things, but you know, everyone has their flaws and everyone has their thing that they do. But then actually, once you start to understand what those things mean, and you know, the idea of mindfulness kind of being what I was talking about as well, or an element of that where you can try and say to yourself in that moment, this isn't forever, and I know it's something I'm going through right in this moment, but it's going to pass and this won't be how I feel maybe even tomorrow or
exactly.
Next year.
I mean, this too shall pass is the most wonderful little phrase to grab hold of in those moments where you just feel like, I am going to be stuck in this forever, or I'm never going to sleep again, or whatever it is. You know, it's either undulating or it passes completely, and we have to sort of surrender to it, I guess. As often you can't combat it. You just have to let go and surrender to it all. I really appreciate you talking about that, Tuppence, because I know it's not, you know, easy to just jump into a conversation with someone you've never met before about all of the inner workings of your brain. But I think it's so helpful. And we haven't really sort of delved into the world of OCD as thoroughly as we should. So it's really fascinating talking to you about that. And as I said, I absolutely loved our house. And I know that everyone is going to be gripped by it because it's just perfect length. Perfect episodes. It's perfectly stressful, manageably stressful.
Yes.
Gripping is the word. And I wish you all the luck with all the busyness, and I hope that you keep feeling, you know, like you're balanced amongst all the kind of chaos and craziness of promoting this and the Downton movie that's coming out soon, etc. I wish you all the best with all of it.
Thank you so much, and I hope you get some sleep soon. I would say we should meet up, but we won't.
I will never see you again, Tuppence, but it's been glorious.
It's been lovely. Staying in the moment.
Oh my gosh, I loved chatting to Tuppence. I love Tuppence. I actually do want to meet up with her. I would really, really love that. I don't think I'd have much angst. It would be a joy to finally meet her, but lovely to talk to her today nonetheless. You can watch Our House on ITV and ITV Hub from the 7th of March, and you really should. It is so gripping. Make sure you're back here next week for another episode of Happy Place by clicking the follow button on your podcast app. And while you're there clicking follow in various places, come and follow us on Instagram too. We're Happy Place Official. Loads of good vibes going on there to help you feel lifted and boosted every day. I absolutely love reading your comments and love seeing you there too, so please do join us. Massive thanks again to Tuppence. Should also add that she has the best name in the world. To the producer, Anushka Tate at Rethink Audio, and to you for listening, you gorgeous lot. I'll speak to you very soon.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.